Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for May the 20th, 2019. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thank you for joining us this evening. We have a special guest tonight, Dr. Ron Chase, as well as news from the VA. First, I'd like to acknowledge our two sponsors of our show, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli, whose financial contribution helps us provide this weekly show for the benefit of veterans and their families across the country. I would also like to remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, your comments, and your questions. So you can call us at any time during the show, toll-free 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number nationwide is 1-888-627-6008. Good evening, Richard.
Hey, David, and good evening, everybody. Tonight, our guest is Dr. Ron Chase, Ronald Chase, born in Brooklyn, New York, who attended James Madison High School. He later attended the University of Louisville, Kentucky, graduating with a Bachelor of Arts degree in 1959, having majored in philosophy and chemistry. He later attended La Sapienza, University di Roma, Italia, for didactic work in medicine, and the Università di Bologna, Italia, for his clinical work in medicine. His postgraduate studies continued with an internship at the University of Florida, Florida University Hospitals. During the Vietnam War, he took a residency in psychiatry at the National Naval Medical Center, U.S. Naval Hospital, Bethesda, Maryland. Child psychiatry at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, Washington, D.C., and at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, Washington, D.C. His early exposure to the internationally acclaimed psychoanalyst Harold F. Searles, M.D., inspired his entire career. Dr. Chase was promoted to Lieutenant Commander, Medical Corps, United States Navy, from 1968 to 1973. He became a fellow of Academy of Psychosomatic Medicine in 1973 during the tenure of Wilfred Dorfman, M.D. Dr. Chase was later stationed at the U.S. Naval Hospital, Orlando, Florida, as Chief of Psychiatry and Psychiatric Consultant to the U.S. Armed Forces, McCoy Air Force Base, Orlando, Florida. In 1973, he began a fellowship at the Chicago Medical School in Psychosomatic Medicine, being mentored by Hyman Garner, M.D., Chair of Department of Psychiatry. Under Dr. Garner's tutelage, he was appointed to head the Psychiatric Liaison Program for the Dialysis and Oncology Programs in Cook County, Chicago, Illinois. Further experience included work at Veterans Administration hospitals, where he developed the first Vietnam Veterans Inpatient Unit for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. He was involved with the State of New York Office of Mental Health and Forensic Services, Division of Parole and other correctional facilities in Florida and New York's Department of Corrections at Rikers Island. He had been a psychiatric consultant for the district attorneys in the New York City area and assistant to the United States Attorney, Eastern District, as expert witness in capital offense cases. In 1994, he was asked to appear on national television Inside Edition as forensic psychiatrist in review of the O.J. Simpson case. In 2008, his concern for the inordinate numbers of suicide deaths among returning soldiers from deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan promoted him to take a position with the U.S. Army as psychiatrist contractor stationed at Wynn Army Community Hospital Behavioral Health Center, 3rd Infantry Division, Fort Stewart, Georgia. Dr. Chase continues to be involved with veterans issues and has written numerous articles and letters regarding PTSD. He recently authored his third book, Stress, God, and Disorder, which is a primer on the manner in which PTSD is treated with interviews and conducted with a three-tour combat Vietnam veteran and an Afghanistan-Iraq soldier. The other half of the book deals with viruses. In addition to Dr. Chase, he continues to work on a documentary regarding his clinical work with PTSD, and that is some resume, Doctor. How are you tonight?
I'm loaded for bear and ready to go fishing.
Okay, well, that's great. We, that is one heck of a heck of a resume. So glad to have you on the show tonight. We've talked a lot. We're going to talk a lot about tonight, about your book and other things. First, though, I'd like to I'd like to hear some of your experience with the VA and veterans, and you know, give me some of your personal historical perspective on, as you like to call it, PTS rather than PTSD.
Well, okay. I've dropped the D from PTSD because my experience has brought me to question whether or not any soldier, sailor, marine, anyone involved in a traumatic experience that's life-threatening, or we leave that to the person to determine what kind of severity the situation was. But in order to be able to sustain and be involved in a trauma, it is normal to have symptoms. Now, I like to say that symptoms are the realities of what we have experienced, and we don't erase them. They remain as real. The trick is to be able to enter into a therapy or a tender, loving care situation with someone the person that has experienced a trauma, is able to relieve himself of what I call the buried pus of the emotional trauma, the thoughts, the feelings, and the memories that need to come out, and they need to be expressed in thought together with the feelings. So I don't consider it a disorder. A person is not disordered. The person has symptoms, yes, completely treatable, at least in the onset. And unfortunately, there had been no programs for what I call the psychological exit strategy from war, in which you receive more than a debriefing. You receive actual therapy from which you're able to return to the battlefield. If not, you have other avenues that the government will find to send you to a VA hospital where you may or may not be treated, or you end up having a disability and you go through the rigors of appearing before all of the various gates you have to go through in order to find a disability hearing. as I indicate, the historical precedence is that I went in 1968, right at the beginning of the first Tet Offensive. And this was at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And being a rookie, I was put on the service of receiving the Aerovacs, and these guys were coming in. You could still smell napalm on them. They weren't 48 hours out of the theater of combat. Well, when they arrived, they either went to medical services in which I would do consultations for their mental health, or they went to a psychiatric ward because that was their natural destination. They were suffering from difficulties with sleep, anger problems. They hated the world. And some of them presented as psychotic as well. And it was hard to distinguish between who had a post-traumatic experience, shell shock, battle fatigue, whatever you wanted to call it in those days, from those that actually had a bona fide condition that might have been amenable to treatment. So I asked around at the officers, the upper rank officers, captains, rear admirals, people that were around during World War II, Korea, and what have you, and I was trying to get information as to, well, how do you treat these guys? Well, actually, they didn't know. They had accompanying problems with alcohol, and they were sent to 12-step programs, and then they would come back, and they still had their problems, regardless of the addiction to alcohol, and there was no known way that they were going to treat them. It was at a time in which Thorazine became a popular medication, and later Haldol, and God only knows what they have today. But those medications seemed to just cover things over, and it wasn't good enough for me. So one day I decided I needed to get these guys all together to see what I could determine in a group. Well, to my amazement, I was able to develop rapport with the combat soldiers. Well, actually, they were probably 90% Marines, because Bethesda took care of the Navy took care of the Marines, and we had a few soldiers in. But during the course of a discussion, these guys became interested in expressing themselves, and they had never spoken a word since they got off the noon balloon from Vietnam. So we started in with conversations. Well, I like to think of it as I was a musical conductor conducting an orchestra of sounds, but they were the thoughts being expressed, the emotions being expressed, to a point in which some of the people were actually transported back in time to the original traumatic event, and some would take cover under the chairs that were in the room as though there was incoming. It was a rather amazing crescendo of voices that really got me started on, hey, I'm onto something here, because my analytic background told me that if you're able to have a patient express what is hidden beneath the surface, what they are really feeling, without saying to them, well, Mr. Jones, what is it you feel about that situation? Now, none of that crap. It was a matter of getting the rapport and being able to have them in a secure environment with their fellow comrades and express themselves emotionally like they've never expressed before. So they were permitted a platform in which they had what is called a catharsis. They're able to vomit out the emotional pus, and each time they would do it in successive meetings, there was a greater sense of relief, camaraderie, and functionality among these guys. So I kept doing this modality and kind of perfected it in my own way and began using it rather successfully, although I was not a researcher trying to use these people as subjects of some kind of essay or project I was doing. This was all coming very natural, and it almost felt like they weren't patients. They were like friends that were just sharing what went on. It was as though if they had that experience right up front, like it used to be in World War One or World War Two, where the wounded, the mental, emotional casualties would be treated in the front line. They wouldn't be sent to the back unless they could not be handled at all. And this just struck me as a bona fide modality to use to teach. And I've enjoyed doing it, and I've seen hundreds of patients. Unfortunately, through the system that they're involved with for dependence on the system for their total health care, a lot of them, I've lost about 90 guys that I've known personally through the years, and several of them had passed before age 40. 37 of them that I was treating at a particular hospital, a VA hospital, were all gone except for three, all before the age of 40. Anyway, I know that their emotional conditions had something to do with their early demises. I mean, I can just keep going on, so, you know, just stop me here.
Let me ask you a question. You talked about, I'm using your words, these symptoms buried deep inside. You know, one of the things that the VA loves to do today is deny a veteran's claim for PTS, saying that it's not service-connected or it wasn't diagnosed, or more commonly, you know, they didn't say anything when they first separated from the service, and it's now only coming up 30 or 40 years later, so it must be something else that's causing this anxiety or depression, and it's not the service. Do you have any feelings about that?
Well, could you restructure that question, because I'm lost with the chronology of it. There are cases you're saying. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the VA likes to say, likes to deny a veteran's claim for PTS by saying, and one of the reasons that they give is it's not service connected because you didn't tell us about, there's no documentation upon separation from the service. And here it is 20 or 30 years later, and now you're claiming PTS. So therefore, it must have been something else. It must have been maybe your uncle beat you, or your father beat you, or your mother beat you, or in the case of a woman who is, or a man who is military sexually traumatized, your sexual trauma must have resulted from something that happened in family. You know, they keep throwing all these little roadblocks, and as you said before, you know, these feelings that these veterans have about their PTSD is buried deep inside. I'm using your words.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, the idea is that a trauma is followed by a set of symptoms. Now, they can get buried real fast. They can get buried under alcohol. They can get buried under drugs. They can get buried by the natural defense mechanisms that were developed and articulated by Anna Freud. The ego and mechanisms of defense. We are capable of having horrible traumas, and our natural response is to try to deny them in some manner possible so they're kept out of our conscious awareness. If they weren't, they would interfere with everyday life. So we do construct a defense system that is normal and natural to maintain an internal equilibrium. In my book, I talk about two famous scientists that talk about the internal and external environments that need to be in harmony and in equilibrium, and the external environment impacts on our lives just as well as the internal within us. It's possible for the symptoms to be hidden, okay, and functional or not so functional, or we become depressed, perhaps. We have overwhelming anxieties keeping hidden what traumas we experienced that may have set it all off. Now, these things aren't always present. They can come about in dreams because we have less control over what we think and feel during the dream states, and we don't necessarily take responsibility for what goes on in dreams. Oftentimes, it's a dream. We get over it and get up and go about our business. But they are indicators of there being a subterranean volcano, okay, put it that way. And yes, it is possible to go on for many years without it being recognized, especially if somebody, let us say, has a construct of an obsessive compulsive type of person that likes things in order. Control is very important, and they would take a job, let's say, in accounting or something like that, where they move beans and marbles around all day, and they're occupied. They do it very well, and nobody knows what lurks underneath the facade of doing well. They can emerge when there are things that they call triggers. I never liked that expression, but there are events that can take place in our lives that bring back memories in some form. They remind us of events which may create a situation in which we have a exacerbation of our symptoms that we never had before. So it could look like somebody after 2 or 3, 4, 8 years after release from service, suddenly they're swamped with what went on. They realize that they lost somebody that was blown up or run over by a half track or whatever the situation was, only because they were at a construction site in New York City and they were using some kind of machinery that reminded them of that particular day, and it's all back. So these things can happen. Now, I don't know where I'm headed with this, but in terms of having evaluations for whether somebody has a PTSD for convenience, but I hate the D, PTSD, I'm going to the VA now, and I have a problem, and I think it's related to the military somehow, my experiences. Okay. Well, in order to establish that this is the case, you need the best longitudinal history that's possible to be able to reconstruct what this person has experienced in order to present a case that supports post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, we know that we're up against the fact that the Veterans Administration is an administration, and the job of the people that work in the disability pension claims divisions are the administrators of the program. They really have nothing to do with the clinical aspects to make any determinations to challenge the status quo of administering the programs. The programs are written in stone. Now, if you can find the way to authenticate a PTSD by working in stone, fine. But what they're left with is this impersonal approach to not delving into any historical longitudinal development to determine PTSD exists, but rather a shotgunning question format in which they hit upon questions that reverberate in some recipe book as to what constitutes post-traumatic stress disorder. I think that any 12-year-old can look in one of those magazines or whatever, and they're all outlined, 12 things that you're supposed to have to, cook the roast, or 12 things you need to have in order to have PTSD. So the VA functions in such a way as to fill in the blanks, that you get questionnaire after questionnaire, never having a real personal sit-down where you can discuss what kind of therapies you've had, so that a narrative summary of what the therapist or the person that has interviewed the veteran has produced, so it can follow, just like a horoscope, but just a historical representation of what is going on with the veteran, starting with the DD-214. Is that looked at? Do they compare the events, statements listed in the DD-214? Does it augur with what the clinical presentation is? Did you really get wounded? Yeah, I really got wounded. Or did you see this and that? Or were you near a concussion blast? Or were you near a munitions dump? Or was your company overrun or whatever? If it's in the DD-214, there is either a denial of, it was never there, and that's everyone scratches their head. What do you mean you were never there? DD-214 says you were there. Okay. So if you were there for any of the events of the DD-214, those things should be expounded upon for therapeutic purposes and for documentation purposes in order to administer the program. So how many times do you say or do you hear a veteran having served 20 years after the fact and goes to the VA and what have you learned in your therapy? What therapy? It's Reese's Pieces. I go to this guy and I tell him the story and then the time is up and he sends me to somebody else and I end up repeating the same story with that guy. And then I go to somebody else with a different kind of a title and I give her the same story because she asked the same questions. And it all follows like these soldiers in a row. And it's gatekeeper after gatekeeper with this formalized questionnaire stuff. I'll tell you, when I was at Fort Stewart, the bell would ring at 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock, whenever, and these guys were returning from Iraq or Afghanistan, whatever. They're coming in on the bus. It was a Friday. They were all hundreds. They were all so eager to get home. They didn't want to go through another questionnaire. They didn't want anything but get off the bus, get outside there, meet with their families, and in some cases, the guys had real problems, not necessarily related to PTSD, but it's indicative of how you get around the questionnaire situation. I remember one guy who he couldn't wait to get out of these lines, endless lines of check areas, of questionnaires. Are you going to kill yourself in the next 24 hours? Basic kind of questions, right? And this guy doesn't care about that because he had received a Dear John letter indicating that his wife had taken all of his money, his car, his everything else, and he can't wait to get out of here to go straighten out his life. So he's going to sit around and talk about a questionnaire that is designed by who knows who, by somebody he's never met, waiting online with all of these guys that are just trying to get out of there. I mean, the questionnaire has little validity in that kind of a situation because questionnaires are dependent upon the time of day, the relationship with the examiner, how you feel that particular day. Maybe I have an off day. I don't feel like talking. So does that make you a depressed person? Maybe you're very happy, you know, something great happened in your life that doesn't mitigate against being miserable for the most, the rest of the time. So, hey, he's a happy guy. It's here today.
About 9 or 10 months ago when I was negotiating all these claims that I have with the VA on behalf of veterans. And specifically, on the PTS that we're talking about. And all of a sudden, the decision review officer on the other end of the line says, well, look, you got to have your independent medical examiner redo his DBQ, disability benefits questionnaire, which we're going to get into in a second. and issue another opinion, because you have to eliminate fear from the opinion.
You have to eliminate what? I'm sorry?
You have to eliminate the feeling of fear. In other words...
Oh, yes. Okay.
The veteran cannot feel fear as a condition of PTS. He can feel all sorts of other things about what happened in the military, but if a nightmare causes fear of reliving something, yeah, you can't put that in the IME's professional opinion, because the VA will kick it back out and say, well, that doesn't meet our, I mean the VA's, diagnosis of PTSD. Mm-hmm. What's odd about this is prior to about 9 or 10 months ago, fear was an element of PTS. And then all of a sudden, 9 or 10 months ago, they eliminated fear. And I, you know, as the defense attorney, I could no longer utilize that feeling, that symptom, on behalf of a veteran. Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, I guess I could look at that in two ways. How one particular symptom with a name or a term, fear is an emotion. So there are probably 100 ways around saying fear. But fear is a human emotion. It can certainly be the result of many inputs. It is a normal emotional feeling. So to eradicate it for the purposes of the administering the program, it is wrong. That is not, it's incomprehensible. Fear is one of the more important symptoms that, I mean, you're talking phobia. Phobia is listed in the, the DSM-5, 6, 4, I don't know what number it is now, in the cookbook. There's phobia. So if one would indicate phobic for whatever the fear was going to be, it's just a different term. Well, how would they exclude a phobia when it's a part of the nosology, the jargon of the world of psychiatry? It's a phobia, fear of spiders, fear of heavy noise of trucks and backfire. That's a fear experience. That's a response. You know, blood pressure would go up, pulse rate would quicken. You have some of the medical equivalents, not necessarily just the emotional. You know, unlike in medicine where you want evidence, well, you can't say, well, let's say a fracture isn't something we can consider now. Or, well, that's absurd. I have an X-ray showing that the bone is broken. Okay, you'd rather me say it's broken than it's fractured. It's a play on words. I have trouble understanding how that could be possible, but I'm hearing you say it. But it depends how a narrative is written in support of the veteran's claim. If the veteran can go and get an IME, independent of the government, which will provide a longitudinal history in which the facts are compatible with the events as stated in the DD-214, and even if it's not on the DD-214, can it be found to be plausible as a conclusion of having been exposed to the traumas of combat or what have you when they're expressed in a form that the examiner is able to compile the dossier, the narrative summary, in such a manner that it covers the symptomatology over the chronological course of the claimant's life. There is a way to prepare the supporting evidence that such a condition exists, if the condition really does exist.
You know, in the DD-214, you'll have under awards, it will say the veteran has a combat, received a combat ribbon medal. He might get a Purple Heart. And in those cases, the VA will concede they will concede the stressor. So in other words, independent medical examiner doesn't have to get into the stressor because it's been conceded by the fact that the veteran received a Purple Heart and therefore the stressor occurred as a result of whatever he did in order to get the Purple Heart. So that's the easy one. And the hard one, though, is when you don't have that. And there are many, many occasions when, even when veterans deserve the Purple Heart and did not get one, that you then have to go forward and you know, get the stressor. Now, we had talked earlier today about these DBQs, Disability Benefits Questionnaire, and I sent you one earlier today, the six-page standard form that the VA utilizes on all of their interviews of veterans, whether it's on the health side or if there's a claim pending, they'll utilize that for the Competence 10 exam to determine whether or not the veteran has PTSD, and if so, what should the evaluation be. Likewise, the IMEs that I use to support a PTSD claim, I have to use the same form because that's what the VA requires. Mm-hmm. They won't let me just have the doctor, my IME, send in a kind of a standard, what I used to utilize in my law practice with using IMEs and in a written narrative. My doctor is confined to that DBQ. There are blocks where they can then express a short narrative if they want. So you've had an opportunity to take a look at those six pages, and I want to get your opinion on that, because when I talk to the decision review officers and we're trying to, you know, we're debating these, you know, whether or not the veteran has PTS, number one, and number two, what the evaluation be. They routinely say to me, well, I've got to look at the report, and I got to look at the boxes. And based on the boxes, I'll get back to you and let you know what my decision is. I'd love to have your opinion on that form and how it's being utilized for and against, more importantly, against the veteran.
Okay. Well, in my view, the use of questionnaire is part and parcel of administering the program. It's a built-in method of information gathering that's so focused that you can end up with the final questionnaire is me. But we know that it can't be you, because you're much more than what that form is. Now, that is one hell of a condensation. I've looked through some of those questions. The questionnaire provides for indirect, impersonal notations that is not directly, clinically obtained. These are impressions that are supposed to correspond with prior questionnaires that are handed down in some chain link manner, and the claimant no doubt has not had one therapy, has not had a relationship with a therapist that has written a comprehensive narrative that documents the chronology. when they throw out the evidence and distill it into a shotgunned question and mark that on some rating scale, they're doing a disservice to the understanding of what the condition is. If you look at the medical side, which I do the medical disability determinations for the Department of Health, the medical evaluations are similar in that there is an administration of a program. However, that program relies heavily on what is called evidence. That evidence in medicine surgery is easier because x-rays provide evidence. Biopsies supply evidence. Treatment therapies, chemicals, chemotherapy, x-ray therapy, whatever, that provides evidence of the existence of certain conditions. However, those conditions have to be met by the administrative criteria. Now, the VA is handicapped in that they're trying to shortcut the evidence. This is a distilled down evidence that represents me, the veteran looking for my benefits or compensation or pension. It's distilled down evidence, but it's not really evidentiary. These are questionnaire driven solutions to the problem. They must have a narrative, and the narrative can be written in such a way that it can comply with what the administration of the program is. But that has to come a lot earlier than the final step for meeting a board for compensation, pension, benefits. I don't know if that touches the subject, you know.
Well, what you know confirms for me is you know, and my job is to, you know, when I have a veteran who has PTS, is to make the best case for him and get him compensated. And the hurdles that I have to go through each and every time for these veterans are somewhat routine, not routine for the veteran him or herself, but routine for me because I have to go through the same thing. Because on the VA side, it's the same roadblock every time.
Right.
And there's always a way around it, but it's a mess. And, you know, when I hear you talk and I can hear the complexity of why it is such a mess, you know, it further supports what I've always said is, you know, deny these men and women PTS because we don't want to pay them.
It wasn't always this way. Everything changed around 1982, I think 83, when the Department of Veterans Affairs became a cabinet level position. Prior to that, the evaluations were done in a different manner. I remember the VA system as having a director, a chief of staff who provided quality care, a chief of service, and the inspector general who would be a non-political, unbiased person who would attack corrective action where it was needed. My dear friend, Rudolph Cumberbatch, Dr. Cumberbatch, is a retired VA official. He's a general surgeon out in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. He wrote a classic book that talked about the, what was the title? Failure Masquerading as Success. That was his book. He talks about how good things were up until the time of the change to the cabinet level when PTSD was so named before which was what? Shell shock, battle fatigue, anxiety-related disorder, psychoneurosis, et cetera. And someone, I think by the name of Kaiser, maybe, I forgot the name, he converted the whole system into an HMO, a concept they believe would be more cost-effective. It was about the money, not the care. It was okay for private care to be an HMO, but not the VA, Department of Veterans Affairs. This gave rise to a painstaking, long process of passing through the gates of primary care and those physicians, before getting to see a specialist like a gastroenterologist. They had now long waiting lists, no outside referrals to other physicians, a new system that created new directors, more directors. And these people came from the ranks at the VA, at the Department of the Veterans Affairs, promoted into a special program of training, and thereby they increased the numbers of directorships. They provided for productivity bonuses, and a large body of physician assistants was created. These were non-MD people, and they replaced the loss of medical doctors and specialists because lower pay was cost-effective. The VA became a game of patient care versus growth of the administration, and that's what they did. They grew the administration, and by so doing, entered into all of these shortcut ways of determining treatment or disability evaluations by the use of questionnaires. It took the place of actual therapists and people that would care. The people writing a questionnaire doesn't really care. There's no compassion in getting shotgunned. Where were you on such and such a week? Well, were you having symptoms then? Yes, no. Well, that's not quite right. But this is administering a system that is a failure, and it needs to be changed, and it needs to have the pressure of, I would think, competent narratives being submitted and accepted if they are written in the framework of the guidelines that they're providing with reference to the longitudinal history as evidence.
You know, Doctor, when hearing you explain it, when my clients go in for the CMP exams, one of the things I tell them is, you know, this is your exam, so when you get in there, you need, I'm going to use your word again, you need to vomit everything about your PTSD symptoms. And don't let the examiner off the hook. They're probably not even going to look at you. They're going to be staring at a stupid computer screen like some geek and not even taking into consideration anything you're even saying about your experience in war, combat, but it's very important that you get it out and you let them know, you know, exactly what happened. Whether or not it appears on the questionnaire is another story, but you at least got to get it out there.
Given an opportunity to be able to do that, but, you know, veterans are very proud people. They don't want to, you know, perform like some kind of circus clown because I'm going to have a benefits test in front of some person who really couldn't care less about what I'm crying over. I'm interfering with the filling out of the form. There's a guy outside waiting to come in here for the same thing.
Exactly. Doctor, we're getting closer. Your new book, Stress, God, and Disorder. Briefly, tell us about your new book and how can some of our listeners get your book? I know it's a pretty involved book, but give us, I want to give you the opportunity to kind of talk about it.
Well, all right. Well, it's involved and it's not involved. I know the subject matter was so difficult that my task was to try to develop a book that was a primer based on my experiences of what therapy is and how to get rid of the stigma of disability or disorder, actually, from PTSD. PTS, post-traumatic stress is an entity. I understand it. It happens if somebody bangs into the back of your car, all right? Well, PTS is plotted against time, all right? So I could have post-traumatic stress from a car fender bender. But if I'm pinned down in some mud swamp in Vietnam or walking through some village in Fallujah, and there's all kinds of crap that breaks out all of a sudden, you know, I'm pretty shaken up by it, even with all of my training and exposure, as to not be phased. I'm getting off the subject here. I'm sorry. Get carried away. So my book has to deal with what is therapy? How do you get therapy? Can you ask yourself and answer the question, what have I learned in therapy regarding post-traumatic stress or whatever is wrong with me? Anyway, so the book was written as a manual to explore the nature of traumatic stress and introduce awareness of factors that facilitate adaptation and mastery over the trauma sustained in reality. And the reality can never be erased. It's always there. Reality is something that you don't remove. You can cover it over, do whatever. It's always there. But the philosophy of the book is to have a catharsis, whether somebody pulls it out of you or you're able to do it because you're on a roll, that's therapeutic. But you have to have someone that knows how to guide you in it. Now, that's half of the book. The other part of the book deals with a term that I coined, media terror, a term that I use to indicate the unrestrained media reporting of traumatic events or diseases that multiplies the collective discontent to the point of global stress. In other words, when my daughter was traumatically killed, years ago, the telephone calls from all of these talking heads on TV wanted the story. They wanted me to talk about it. Or, well, it's none of their business. You know, this isn't a spectacle. This is not something that's newsworthy. 9/11, okay, that was newsworthy. Lots of people lost their lives. But the constant bombardment of the 9/11 created more problems for people. I happen to have seen some of them at Rikers Island, actually, had experienced the 9/11 when bodies were falling out of the buildings. And some of these guys had those similar experiences in Vietnam. And it brought them to their knees, basically. But, you know, how do you consider that? Well, the media has all of that. And I'm at war with the media, I guess. So the book probes the efforts to reveal the backstory of the inquiry to understand the complexities involved in caring for survivors. And the prototype I used was the original group in 1968. And the one particular soldier who was involved at some point with the CIA and the My Lai incident and all of that kind of stuff. And I actually have him on videotape. And another was a fellow in, I've forgotten where in Iraq he was. and what he experienced in the impersonal manner in which he was able to be a gunner in a tank, and it transformed into a video game. So he got through the experience of blowing away a couple of children that bothered him about a year later when he came home on leave and had to be with his own kids. He really went to pieces there. But these are the experiences that that I have put in the book in an hour-long interview, indicating what they're saying, what I'm thinking, what I have to do in order to help facilitate the catharsis, the bringing to the fore in a constructive manner, so he can really look at what he's saying, what he's thinking, what he's feeling, and how it plays a role years after the fact. So this is how one gets to master the reality, not by hiding it, but bringing it forward, which is something the veterans don't help us to do.
Exactly. Doctor, I hate to cut you off. You can go on and on. Maybe we'll have to bring you on another show in the very near future. But how can our listeners get your book? I assume we can get it on Amazon?
Yeah, I'm on Amazon. The name of this book is Stress, God, and Disorder. And the second, there's a half of the book that deals with the issues that I had to confront in the mid-80s when veterans who had been through all of the phases of drinking, drugging, criminality, divorce, unemployment, homelessness, whatever, and they turn up positive for HIV.
Well, Doctor, we're going to have to leave it there. But listeners,
okay,
if you'd like to get Dr. Chase's book, again, go to Amazon, and you can order it there. Doctor, I want to thank you very much for appearing on the Veterans News Hour. And look forward to talking to you again. And again, we'll get you on the, get you back on the show. But thanks again.
Great.
Really appreciate it. Take care now.
Thanks, Dr. Chase.
Good luck to the guys. Right.
Thank you.
Anytime. Sure.
All right. Bye-bye. David, why don't you finish us off?
Okay, well, thanks again to our special guest, Dr. Ron Chase. It's time for us to go this evening. I'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour. We'll see you back next week, so please tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Have a great week. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.